From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
Someday I'll have me a chauffeur and a block-long limousine, EO11. EO11.
That's Sammy Davis Jr. singing the theme from the 1960 film Ocean's 11, which starred Sammy Davis, Frank Sinatra, Dean Martin, and the rest of the Rat Pack. The new version of Ocean's 11 opens this week. On today's Fresh Air, we talk about the original with its leading actress, Angie Dickinson. We'll also talk about her other films and her TV series, Policewoman. And we'll talk about Sammy Davis Jr. and the contradictory images he represents within African-American culture with Gerald Early, editor of the new book, The Sammy Davis Jr. Reader. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
EO11.
First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. Israeli warplanes and helicopters today launched their fiercest attacks in 14 months of violence. One missile exploded near Palestinian President Yasser Arafat's West Bank office while he was inside. Arafat was not hurt, but a 15-year-old bystander and a policeman were killed. The attacks are a response to Palestinian suicide bombings in Israel over the weekend that killed more than two dozen civilians. The BBC's Philip Allen is in Jerusalem, where he prepared this report.
2 days ago, the sirens were Israeli. Now, as the familiar cycle of action and reaction turns once more, ambulances race through Palestinian streets, Ramallah, Tulkarem, and Gaza. It's been another day of warplanes and helicopter gunships. A rocket lands close to Mr. Arafat's Ramallah office. Israel says the Palestinian leader is not a target. But West Bank Fatah leader Marwan Barghouti feels, as many Palestinians do, that this is all getting dangerously personal.
Yeah, of course. When they bombed his offices yesterday and today morning, they are trying to kill Mr. Arafat.
Last night, as Ariel Sharon's Israeli government officially branded the Palestinian Authority a terror-supporting entity, the Foreign Minister Shimon Peres said Mr. Sharon was going too far.
The BBC's Philip Allen in Jerusalem. The U.S. is now joining Israel in the fight against the suicide bombers. The Bush administration is freezing the assets of an Islamic charitable foundation with alleged links to Hamas, the Palestinian group that has claimed responsibility for the bombings. The head of the Environmental Protection Agency, Christine Todd Whitman, has decided to order the dredging of PCBs from the Hudson River. From member station WAMC, Lisa Phillips reports.
The decision is similar to the cleanup plan issued by Whitman's predecessor, Carol Browner. It calls for dredging 150,000 pounds of polychlorinated biphenyls, or PCBs, from the upper Hudson River. Environmentalists had feared the decision would include strict performance standards that might scuttle the project, but the EPA decided to develop them later. Scenic Hudson spokeswoman Jean McGrain called the EPA's announcement a victory.
It's been a long struggle to get this decision. This is our step to getting the final cleanup. We had to have this or we couldn't go forward.
The decision now goes to New York State environmental officials for review. It's expected to be finalized in January. For NPR News, I'm Lisa Phillips in Albany, New York.
NASA today postponed the launch of the space shuttle Endeavour. The launch was scrubbed just minutes before the scheduled liftoff today because of threatening weather in Florida. NASA officials say they'll try again tomorrow. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 130 points to 98.93. The Nasdaq was up 58 points. This is NPR. The U.S. Postal Service ended its fiscal year with a loss of $1.7 billion. The drop is being blamed on the nation's sluggish economy and tough competition. NPR's Dave Mattingly reports.
The Postal Service had been bracing for a loss of $2 billion earlier in the year. That prompted some cost-cutting. Then came the terrorist attacks of September 11th. The $1.7 billion loss only covers the 3 weeks following the attacks when mail volume dropped. The attacks involving anthrax spores through the mail occurred after that time. Chief Financial Officer Richard Strasser says the anthrax problems will cost the Postal Service even more, billions more. Congress has been asked to help offset those expenses, and the Postal Service is seeking a 3-cent hike in the cost of first-class stamps beginning next year. Dave Mattingly, NPR News, Washington.
A Massachusetts judge has ordered home confinement for a high school student accused of plotting a Columbine-style attack. The judge says there is clear and convincing evidence that Eric McKeon and others planned an attack, but she said she did not agree that McKeon was dangerous enough to keep in jail. She ordered the 17-year-old to wear an electronic monitor and to meet with a probation officer daily. There's a new computer virus on the loose. It's called Goner. It promises the recipient a new screensaver, but in fact, if the attachment is run, it will be sent to everyone on the address book. It can also be sent itself through an instant messaging program called ICQ. Aside from that program, it only affects Microsoft's Outlook and Outlook Express email programs on computers running Windows. I'm Frank Stacio, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo and its employees, working together in the Sodexo Stop Hunger program, on the web at SodexoUSA.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new movie Ocean's 11 opens this Friday. The original Ocean's 11, made in 1960, was a vehicle for the Rat Pack. Frank Sinatra starred as Danny Ocean, a singer and gambler who has assembled a team of 11 men to rob 5 Vegas casinos. The team includes Sammy Davis Jr., Dean Martin, Peter Lawford, and Joey Bishop. Capitol Records has just released 2 Rat Pack CDs, The Rat Pack Live at the Sands and EO 11. Angie Dickinson co-starred in the original Ocean's 11 as Sinatra's estranged wife. Dickinson also starred opposite John Wayne in Rio Bravo, Lee Marvin in The Killers and Point Blank, Burt Reynolds in Sam Whiskey, and Roger Moore in The Sins of Rachel Cade. From 1974 to 78, she starred in the TV crime drama Policewoman. In 1999, when Playboy published its list of the 100 sexiest stars of the century, she was number 42. Let's start with Angie Dickinson in a scene from Ocean's 11. Sinatra wants to meet up again with his estranged wife, but he knows she'd refuse to come. So he gets Dean Martin to trick her into coming by saying that Sinatra is very sick. But she's figured out the real story.
Why'd you come over if you knew it was a gag?
Why, it's Christmas. And I have a present for him, as simple as that. Now, what's your excuse?
I was wondering what it is. I come to the conclusion it must be love. Mother love.
I'll consider mistress, plaything, toy for a night, but I refuse to be your mother. That's out.
No, you got it all wrong. I'm the mother. I just don't like you and Danny busting up.
Yeah. We're sort of eye to eye there.
I'd like to straighten him out.
No, mother. He's the only one who can do that.
I asked Angie Dickinson about her performance in Ocean's 11.
There was no great delving into figuring out how to play any part in this movie. It was far from Shakespeare. And so I just played it as a warm woman of her own, not her own means, but she was her own woman. And instead of succumbing to all of their charms, she said, you know, no, I'm moving on. But it was pretty cut and dried.
Well, let me play a scene of you not succumbing to Frank Sinatra's charms. and this is a scene where you're meeting up with him after many years, and he's trying to get back with you, at least for a short trip.
It's hard to say no to Frank. It always was. For many people, not just for women, he was a very, very delectable persuasion. He was just fabulous.
Now just sit there and don't interrupt me. I've got a very big deal going on. Large chips, carloads of them.
That sounds familiar.
That might be so, but this time it's true.
Oh, good. I like to have rich friends.
This is one rich friend who wants to spend a bundle on you.
Gee, thanks.
Okay, that's settled. On the morning of January the 2nd, I'm going to pick you up. I'm going to hop down to Rio. So you pack a bag.
You're serious? I honestly think you're serious.
Of course I'm serious.
A week's trip to Rio?
Yes.
Oh, Danny, what a prize you are. The only husband in the world who'd proposition his own wife.
What was it like to work with Sinatra on the set, since you already knew him? I don't know whether you were just friends then, or were you whether you already had a deeper relationship.
He was, I think he was seeing Juliette Prowse during this time. I'm almost positive about that. So that was good, because it doesn't work very well when you're romantic, because things can happen at home and interfere on the set and vice versa. So we were just friends at that time. And it was very special, because if you knew him personally, then you knew of his childish ways of liking to pull practical jokes. He was one of the great ones for that, and laughed just as hard when somebody pulled a practical joke on him. So you're always waiting for somebody to light that stink bomb under the pool table, which they did several times.
During the making of the movie?
Oh, yes, right during the scene.
Were you used to that on the set? I mean, you'd made several movies by then. Were you used to those kinds of shenanigans?
No, that doesn't go on sets. It costs too much, and you've got too many people involved. You've got to keep your nose to the grindstone. Now, this was a very special movie. Nothing like that, except for very, very rarely. I mean, there was no Jim Carrey at the time, and perhaps or Robin Williams, where you don't know what's coming. But basically, on a movie, you stick to the scene, but not on Ocean's 11. They were just always playing and having a blast all the time.
Were you bothered by the attitude toward women in Ocean's 11? Look, for example, in an early scene, a scantily clad blonde is giving a massage to Peter Lawford, and Sinatra comes in and basically, like, shoos her away. You know, I mean, the women, there are women in it who are like little sex toys. Not you, but other women characters. Mm-hmm. Did that kind of attitude bother you either in the film or in real life hanging out with the Rat Pack?
No, that didn't bother me in the film. I always thought it was amusing. And I suppose I will get a lot of hisses and boos for that, but that happens to be the truth. Now, even if it had happened to me, it was kind of... It was not done seriously. It was done tongue-in-cheek. We enjoyed ourselves. If somebody said, hey, you're a great broad, you said, thank you. It was okay then for men to be men and women to be women.
Why do you think the guys in the Rat Pack needed a group? I mean, a lot of people like to be loners. But there was a period when, you know, Sinatra and Sammy Davis Jr., Dean Martin... Peter Lawford, they hung together and they were identified together.
I think Frank always liked company. You were not one of his favorites if you didn't hang in there. He was a nightclub person. He was a late person all his life, and he did not want to stay up late alone. Whereas Dean Martin was very much a loner. He liked going home, not necessarily alone, but not with a bunch around him, maybe a lady or one friend. But Frank always enjoyed the more the merrier if they were his pals. And Sammy liked people around him. I think that came from the stage and nightclub where you're basically entertaining all the time.
When you were romantically involved with Sinatra, was it ever annoying to have him always want to be in a crowd?
No, it's not even a matter of wanting to be in a crowd. He just didn't want to be alone.
Right, but wanting to have, like, good friends surrounding him, yeah.
I'm one of these that says, I mean, all right, already, we saw them last night. Can't we just... see somebody else tonight. He had a tendency to stay with people that he was safe with, very comfortable with, and, you know, no facade. And so he found that very protective. Since I didn't need that, I was not a Sinatra, and there was only one, we'll never know what it's like to be watched every breath you take and analyzed and criticized and judged or adored. So he needed that shield of friends around him where he could totally be himself and not feel ogled. And so I understood that. But yeah, I would have. I'm more the loner.
How did you first meet Sinatra?
I first met Frank on the very first job I ever had. I was a secretary out of a year of college, not knowing what I wanted to be in my future. And so I was capable of being a secretary and tired of studying for a master's degree or something that I didn't know what I wanted to do. And so I entered a beauty contest one day, and I won it. I was one of six winners. And the person from the Colgate Comedy Hour, which was a show on every Sunday night in 53, called the number I left on the form I filled out when I entered the beauty contest and asked if I wanted to be on the show, meaning the Jimmy Durante show. That was the show he cast. And I said, well, I can't act. And he said, well, can you walk? And I laughed, of course, and I said, yes. He said, well, do you want the job or not? And I said, oh, well, yes, I'd love it. Well, that's how I got into show business. It knocked at my door. And I went to that first day of rehearsal, and there, as I opened the door, was Frank Sinatra rehearsing and playfully carrying on with Jimmy Durante. They were rehearsing a number for the show, and magic happened, and in my brain, and I said, this is what I want. This is the kind of world I've been looking for, something where I wanted to fit in, and this was it.
But you had no acting experience. You told them that you didn't know how to act, so what did you do to learn?
Well, I went right to acting school immediately because I didn't want to be a failure, and I certainly didn't want to be a joke, and I certainly didn't want a no income. So I wasn't going to pursue this if I couldn't do it well. So I immediately started studying acting and went four nights a week after work all day for about 4 years. And but in about a year or two, I could tell that I could be okay in it.
Well, you ended up, after you had worked for a few years, starring in a great Western, Rio Bravo, which was directed by Howard Hawks. It also starred John Wayne, Dean Martin, and Ricky Nelson.
Yeah, and Walter Brennan,
who
practically made the movie. I know he's not billed as one of the stars, but boy, didn't he make it special. That's a very good example of the woman's role was almost always just, I used to call it, waving goodbye to the husband on the horse or running into his arms when he came back. And that was the typical role for a woman in a Western, with the exception of Destry Rides Again, Marlena Dietrich, and Feathers in Rio Bravo. She was very, very, very much her own again, and didn't cower around the men. She held her own, and it was early in the feminist type of view. Howard Hawks was very well known for making all of his women quite strong, whether it was Westerns or I Was a Male War Bride or Bringing Up Baby. He liked strong women. He married strong women.
What's your favorite scene in Rio Bravo?
Well, the favorite scene that I had to do was the last scene where Duke is comes up, and I don't know what he comes up to see me for, and he sees me in this rather risque outfit. He says, what are you doing in that? And she says, I'm going down to sing. She says, you didn't know I could sing, did you? He says, you're not going down there in that outfit. And she starts to cry. I thought you'd never say it. He said, say what? And she says, that you love me. And he says, I didn't say that. She says, yes, you did. You just don't know it yet. And it's just wonderful.
Well, why don't we hear that scene?
Okay.
Where are you going?
Downstairs.
You better not.
Wyatt, I better not.
Because I'm still sheriff. You wear those things in public, I'll arrest you.
You... Oh, John T. I've waited so long for you to say that. I thought you were never... You know, the funniest way of saying things. Just when
well,
I think
right,
you're going to say one thing, you say
now.
Something
Get
else.
Get those darn things off. I'll wait outside.
No. You don't have to go. I can use the screen. Besides, I want you to stay here because the other thing is all over now, isn't it? I'm trying to hurry, but I'm all thumbs. What I had to go through, put on these tights, ask a lot of questions, start to walk out. I thought you were never going to say it.
Say what?
That you loved me.
I said I'd arrest you.
It means the same thing. You know that. You just won't say it.
A scene from Rio Bravo with John Wayne and Angie Dickinson. She'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Angie Dickinson, and she was one of the stars of Ocean's 11, the original film. And in conjunction with the release of the new movie, there's a couple of Rat Pack records that have been released, EO 11, The Best of the Rat Pack, and The Rat Pack Live at the Sands. Now, you also made a couple of movies with Lee Marvin, The Killers and Point Blank. You've worked with your share of tough guys in movies, and you've been pretty tough yourself in some films. I'm wondering what it brought out in you to work up against some pretty macho actors.
Well, I guess it brought out my courage to use my full potential. It's a tricky thing. If you get with a strong man, if you get too strong a woman, it's abrasive and it doesn't work on screen. You get them too weak and you don't believe it either. It's a very fine line, and I think that's why I got the parts I did. Not so much my acting ability, which I hope constantly improved, but a quality that was strong in its femininity more than anything, I think. I think I was not against them. I was not opposition to them.
But you had this cool, this kind of reserve or detachment.
See, I don't even know all that. I'm glad. If you say that, and I hope you're right, I'm glad. But, you know, you are what you are, and you do what you do, and if it works, thank God. But I don't know why it works, and sometimes it doesn't. But against those macho guys, and they were, I sure worked with almost all of the best of those leading men, it worked.
In The Killers, you start opposite Lee Marvin. Ronald Reagan was the heavy in that. I think it was the last movie that he made. Were you surprised when he became president?
You know, with all due respect, and I do adore President Reagan, and saw him on, I would say, 6 or 7 social occasions after he was president and while he was president. But very surprised when he became president, yes. He was, since that was his last, he did that film because he had a contract to satisfy. He owed Universal one more picture, and they said, this is it. And he said, okay, get it over with. He didn't like the movie at all and his character, and rightly so, but he just wanted to end that contract and get on with politics. So he was studying all the time on the killers. He was always reviewing and delving into huge piles of paper. He was on his way to become governor then. And I was most surprised, yes. Although he couldn't have been lovelier on the set, he just didn't strike me as presidential material, but he sure was.
Did you vote for him?
I did not vote for Ronnie, I'm sorry. I'm a Democrat.
Did it still hurt to not vote for a friend?
Yes, it does. You don't feel like a traitor, but it's a little harder to put that X down opposite him. Yes, because I really liked him and always did like him. I always liked Nancy very much. Used to run into her because we all lived in Brentwood, and used to run into her in the store, and she was always so nice, but I still was loyal.
Angie Dickinson will be back in the second half of the show. She co-starred with the Rat Pack in the 1960 movie Ocean's 11. Capitol Records has released two Rat Pack CDs, EO 11 and the Rat Pack Live at the Sands. The new Ocean's 11 opens Friday. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
You make me feel so young. You make me feel so spring has sprung. And every time I see you grin, I'm such a happy individual. The moment that you speak, I wanna go play hide and seek. I wanna go and bounce the moon just like a toy balloon. You and I are just like a couple of tots running across a meadow, picking up lots of forget-me-nots. You make me feel so young. You make me feel there are songs to be sung, bells to be rung, and a wonderful fling to be flung. And even when I'm old and gray, I'm gonna feel the way I do today. 'Cause you make me feel so young. You make me feel so young. You make me feel so spring has sprung. And every time I see you grin, I'm such a happy individual. The moment that you speak, I want to.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Bantam Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Honorable Company, a novel of India Before the Raj, by Alan Mallison. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
We're closer than pages that stick in a book. We're closer than ripples that play in a brook.
Coming up, Gerald Early talks about Sammy Davis Jr. and the contradictory images he represents within African American culture. Early edited the new book, The Sammy Davis Jr. Reader. And we continue our conversation with Angie Dickinson.
We're closer to Bobby is to JFK. Not a soul can bust this team in two. We stick together like glue. And when it's a sleeping time,
that's when we rise.
We start to swing.
Swing to the sky.
Our clocks don't chime.
What a surprise.
They ring.
A ding ding. A happy new year. And now to repeat what I said at the start, they'll need a large crowbar to break us apart. We're alone but far from blue.
Before we get finished, we'll make the town roar. We'll make all the late spots and then a few more.
we wind up at Jilly's right after Tootshaw. Life is gonna be a wee wow wee.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Angie Dickinson. She co-starred in the 1960 film Ocean's 11. The new Ocean's 11 opens Friday. Her other movies include Rio Bravo, The Killers, Point Blank, and The Sins of Rachel Cade. Now, you know, as we mentioned, you've worked with really strong men during your career, and you had relationships with really strong men, a long relationship with Sinatra. You were married to Burt Bacharach for many years. Now, you were very famous as well. A lot of women have experienced, and I think this might have been particularly true before the women's movement, this sense that they were overshadowed by strong men, or that they feared that they would be overshadowed by strong men in their lives. And I'm wondering if that was ever an issue for you, or whether, you know, your career was so strong yourself that that was not something you had to be concerned about.
Well, I'm not sure about that. I don't think I ever felt overshadowed, except I must have, because I remember one time when Burt Bacharach got very popular, and I loved it until they pushed me aside, and then I didn't like it. And it isn't that I didn't want his fame to be his, but I didn't want to lose mine in the face of it. And so I guess there was a problem there I didn't realize. I'll tell you this. This is embarrassing. I'm going to tell you. In about 74, April or March or April of 74, which is before Police Woman, Burt was still very popular, and Jack Haley Jr. was producing the Academy Awards, and they asked Burt to be on. And I had been on six or seven Academy Awards shows, and they didn't ask me. And I called Jack Haley Jr. and I said, "What? You're asking Burt and you're not asking me?" Well, about 5 years ago, I ran into Jack Haley and I said, "I can't believe what I did back in 74, and he laughed so hard. He said, "You did. You called and you said, how can you put him on and not me?" And they put me on, and I've been embarrassed ever since.
Now, when you said that you didn't like it when they pushed you aside, when your husband Burt Bacharach was so popular, what they are you talking about?
Oh, well, the publicists, one of the biggest publicists in town. Angie, excuse me, could you move out, please, just, you know, so we can get this picture here. Oh, wow. That was really, that really burnt. Now, I feel embarrassed to say that now, too, because if he was that popular, that's fine. But it really hurt to be not wanted.
Well, shortly after that incident, which you say was in 1974, you got
well,
cast...
Well, the Jack Haley incident was 74.
Yeah, you got cast as the star on the TV series Police Woman, which a series you did for about 4 years. You played Sergeant Pepper Anderson, a divorced woman working undercover. This is a pretty groundbreaking series because you had, like, a woman action hero starring in prime time.
It was absolutely groundbreaking. There was none before. And that's why I mentioned the date, is because I just happened to look it up the other day, and I realized that I had not reemerged yet in 74. I did when I came on with the show, but that was around September or so.
Mm-hmm.
The only shows that succeeded to star a woman were the comedies, and this was the first drama starring a woman, our show. And the first cop that succeeded. There were a couple of other attempts that they died off right away. So I'm very proud of that.
How did it affect your personal life to do TV for 4 years?
It broke it. They don't even do what I did anymore because they have more of a team. It's just virtually impossible to do what I did, to be in everything and to work 12 hours a day and every day. So I had no social life. I didn't see a foreign movie for 5 years. I look at that. I used to love to go to the best movies, and that was my criterion to say I never had the extra time to go take in a foreign movie in all that time. So I lost friends, lost a husband. My daughter still talks about how lonely she was for 4 years while I was at work. So it takes a terrible toll.
The husband you lost is when you broke up with Burt Bacharach.
Oh yeah, but we—I would have lost him anyway because we were—we just—we weren't going to make it. But it contributed to it early.
My guest is Angie Dickinson. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Angie Dickinson is my guest, and one of the many movies that she made is the original Ocean's 11. And in conjunction with the new movie, Ocean's 11, there's a couple of Rat Pack records that have been released. EO 11, The Best of the Rat Pack, and The Rat Pack Live at the Sands. Angie Dickinson, you started acting in the 1950s. Of all the different fashion eras that you've worked through, what were some of the best and worst trends in clothing, hair, and makeup? Some of the best and worst.
The 50s were the pits. The 50s for the clothes was the worst. The 50s for the hair was the worst. We all looked like Esther Williams. I certainly did. And
Bouffant hair?
No, Bouffant didn't come till the 60s.
Well, those tight curls, is that what you mean?
Yeah, tight curls.
Yeah, yeah.
And Doris Day, we all, I mean, you're hard-pressed sometimes to say, is that Lana Turner or is that me? Because the hairstyles and the clothes were so similar. There was no individuality and no rebellion yet. So the 60s for the clothes, for the men, was great. That was the first time with the Beatles wearing their hair, quote, long, which was not long. But they had sideburns and long hair. And then for costume, they had beads and Nehru jackets and wild colors and bell-bottom pants. And the miniskirt was the greatest change for especially for somebody who had some good-looking legs. And they were good on women without great-looking legs. It was just wonderfully revolutionary. You now could be an individual with your hair and your wardrobe. Shoes. Excuse me for interrupting. Shoes. You didn't wear flat shoes, well, unless you were 6 feet tall. In the 50s, you wore high heels and broke our feet doing it. Even in the 60s, when I lived in New York with Burt Bacharach, you didn't wear sneakers on the street. I still was in high heels, struggling to walk home. So also the 60s gave us flat shoes that were stylish. I'm not talking about that there were no flat shoes, but they weren't stylish before the 60s. So
they wore those pale lipsticks in the 60s, those pale pinks.
Yeah, I always wore pale lipstick. I don't even know what I wore in the 50s, but in the 60s, that was certainly my era. And I know Jose Ibert, the great hairdresser, he says, you and Anne Margaret, you never change. You're in the same makeup all these years, and it always looks great. I'm not sure how great I look in it, but I just can't let go of that. And I wear pale lipstick because I look dreadful in dark lipstick. There's only one reason why I wear it.
How did you become a blonde?
I became a blonde because I was doing a movie newly under contract to Warner Brothers. This might interest you as the feminist kind of aura of human rights. Howard Hawks finished Rio Bravo, and he put me under contract for it, of course. And I was thrilled to sign to be under contract to Howard Hawks. Then he asked for a 9-month postponement, or a 6-month postponement, I think it was, before he started paying me. And I had to give it to him, of course, because it was about a year after the movie was made that it was released. And one day, my agent told me I was going to get a part, a test for a part in The Bramble Bush at Warner Brothers. And I said, oh, great. So I went to the studio, and I said, hi, I'm Angie, and I'm here to test for something on stage 8. And they said, we'll get your pass for you. You've got your permanent pass right here. And I said, no, I'm just coming to screen test. They said, no, you've got a permanent pass. It's right here. I said, what do you mean? He says, you're under contract here. And that's how I found out from the guard at the gate that I was sold by Howard Hawks to Warner Brothers, which did not make me happy. And so I got the part. But since Barbara Rush was a brunette, and I was a brunette, they, of course, couldn't have two women the same color. They blonded my hair.
And that
seems so silly to me because, but that's how they, it was a very ordinary movie and not very good. And it stuck. I got to like it and I kept it.
But, you know, it's true. Like, actresses used to be seen as like the blonde or the brunette. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was such, it was seen as such an important defining characteristic.
Yes. Well, above all, you must not mix them up.
Right.
Now, I don't think I look anything like Barbara Rush at all. But when you think back, I must say, I go to some movies now and I say, I think that's so-and-so, or is it so-and-so? They look quite a bit alike. So perhaps the producer was right, but it certainly worked out fine for me because the blonde did, it worked better for me. I had very icky dark brown hair. Still do.
Now, let me ask you, you eventually ended up insuring your legs with Lloyd's of London for $1 million. And that got a lot of publicity. Was that a studio publicity stunt, or did they actually need you to insure your legs?
No, they insured my legs because this was when I was after Warner Brothers contract and I finished that or got out of it. Then I went to Universal. I was auditioning for the role of Gregory Peck's romantic interest in Captain Newman, M.D., and they said, you will get the part if you sign a 7-year contract. And I thought, oh, God, here we go again. Get stuck in stupid movies for 7 years. But I had no choice. I wanted that movie, and it was a real coup at the time. So I accepted that. And so now they had to build me as a star if I was going to be worth my weight. And so they would do different tricks. And one of them was to insure my legs. So I said, now, you guys, is this legitimate or is this just a gag? And they said, no, it's legitimate, but just don't ask us how long. So I suppose they insured them for the minimal amount of time, whether it was a week, an hour, or a day. I'm sure it wasn't for more than a week.
Right.
But it worked very nicely. It was very good publicity. They were pretty legs, and there is something about pretty legs.
Angie Dickinson, thank you so much for talking with us.
Terry, I loved it.
Angie Dickinson co-starred in the 1960 Rat Pack film Ocean's 11. The new Ocean's 11 opens this Friday. The film has inspired the release of 2 new Rat Pack CDs on Capitol Records featuring Sinatra, Dean Martin, and Sammy Davis Jr. My guest, Gerald Early, is the editor of the new book, The Sammy Davis Jr. Reader. It's an anthology of essays from the 50s till now. Early wrote the introductory essay. Early is also the author of The Culture of Bruising, Essays on Prize-Fighting Literature and Modern American Culture, and he's the editor of the Muhammad Ali Reader. He's been a contributor to Fresh Air. He's a professor at Washington University in St. Louis. Gerald Early also wrote the liner notes for the Sammy Davis box set, Yes, I Can. Here's the title track.
Yes, I can. Suddenly, yes, I can. Gee, I'm afraid to go on has turned into yes, I can. Take a look, what do you see?
133 pounds of confidence, me. Got the feeling I can do anything. Yes, I can. Something that sings in my blood is telling me, yes, I can. I was just born today. I can go all the way, yes. I can.
As you point out, during part of the 50s and 60s, Sammy Davis was one of the best-known African-Americans in America. In the entertainment world, he was seen as representing two opposite extremes. Some people saw him as representing the civil rights movement and the strides that African-Americans were making in breaking into, you know, the mainstream entertainment world, but other people saw him as an Uncle Tom. Can we talk about those two contradictory visions of Sammy Davis? Let's start with him representing the civil rights movement.
Well, it's interesting about Davis and the civil rights movement. He won the Spingarn Medal from the NAACP in the late 60s, which is one of the highest awards you can get, civil rights awards you can get, which was given to him because of all the work he had done for the civil rights movement and all the money he had raised. He did have an association with the civil rights movement that was quite visible and quite important, and he certainly got written up a lot for it when he was in the black press. Davis was also a guy that a lot of people thought was a sellout. One, I think it had to do with his personality and his striving to be so sincere with people, which I think a lot of people thought was just sort of obsequious and distasteful a lot of times. Part of it, I think, had related to his size. He was a very small man, and I think his size made him seem more overwhelmed by people around him than he might really have been. I think his physical size tended to make people in some ways kind of disrespect him in combination with the personality that he had. Then he always seemed like he was someone who wanted to be around white people. And his conversion to Judaism in the late 1950s, the marriage to My Brit in 1960, were all things that made people think, oh, this is a guy who he's a white wannabe. And so what's interesting about that is the kind of life that he was striving for, as he made clear in his autobiography, Yes, I Can, was actually the life that Martin Luther King and the Civil Rights Movement was supposedly fighting for. A black person can live this kind of life, and a black person can marry whoever he wants and can associate with whomever he wants and can live the kind of life that he wants, and he doesn't have to live a life that's confined by his race. So in that respect, he was kind of making his life a rather daring public statement. But it was precisely the sort of thing that people didn't like. Not only a lot of black people didn't like it, but there were even white people who were rather uncomfortable with the way he chose to live his life and the kind of personality that he projected.
You write, part of what made Sammy Davis interesting to the American public was that he was so publicly desperate as a Negro. What do you mean?
If you read Yes, I Can, I mean, here's a guy who so much wants, first of all, he's tremendously self-conscious about being black. I mean, on the one hand, Sammy Davis wants to kind of present himself as someone who is very comfortable with being black. But on the other hand, it's very clear from the way he acted that he, in many respects, he was very uncomfortable being black. I mean, he was very uncomfortable in some respects, but his whole physical appearance. Being black is something he talked about a great deal. And he also talked a great deal in his books about being ugly. And
Being short, having a broken nose.
I mean, he thought he was an ugly man. And one would rather expect that with the kind of performer that he was and that he was a dancer and so forth, that he would be very aware of himself as a physical specimen. And being black was part of that as well. So I think it all kind of merged together in his mind in many respects. But he came along at a time when black performers were trying to break out of the confined sort of black entertainment world and cross over. I mean, cross over in a way that was different from, let's say, the way Louis Armstrong crossed over and to get a wide audience, or Fats Waller crossed over and get a wide audience. I mean, Davis emerged after World War II with a cohort of people like Portier, Eartha Kitt, Dorothy Dandridge, Lena Horne. I mean, he emerged with that cohort of people, essentially. And their crossing over was meant to be something different than what the earlier generation. And I think Davis's crossing over was was very much an idea that he wanted to blend in, and he wanted to bring certain kind of distinctive elements of himself as a Negro, but he wanted to make sure that those elements were pleasing to a white audience, that they didn't really disturb or bother a white audience. And I think that the pressures under which he operated in order to do what he did produced a certain kind of desperation in him. I mean, if you read his books, the tone of how he often described what he was about, he sounds very much like a man who's rather desperate.
My guest is Gerald Early, editor of the new anthology, The Sammy Davis Jr. Reader. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Just how I'll guard our love. So love me, please love me. If it's the last thing I do, I will take your hand.
My guest Gerald Early is the editor of the new anthology, The Sammy Davis Jr. Reader. Frank Sinatra and Dean Martin used to mock Sammy Davis in performance. They'd mock him for being black and for having converted to Judaism. Of course, Sinatra and Martin would mock each other for being Italians, but somehow it seemed more cutting with Sammy Davis. Here's a track recorded live at the Sands in 1963. Sammy Davis is doing some of his impressions, and Sinatra and Martin are in the background putting him down.
Ladies and gentlemen, as you know, this song was written for the man. And not too many people sing it. We'd like to have you meet a few people singing the song. We'd like to offer some impersonations, if we may.
Oh, good idea, Sam.
Well, why don't you get forward there, get on your horse, and get the hell out of here. The Yiddish are coming, the Yiddish are coming, the Yiddish are coming.
Day, 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 day. But I love you, and don't you forget.
And I love booze, and don't you.
I'm telling you, boy, you guys have a ball because you ain't got many rights left. I would like...
So is your old man.
Have you meet, first of all, Mr. Nat King Cole.
Was a merry old soul. And the merry old soul was Nat King Cole. Better keep smiling, Sam, so everybody knows where you are.
I tell you guys, if we ever get in the lead, you two are going to be first.
No, we ain't, because we're going to join you in Africa.
I ain't going to Africa, baby.
I can't go there.
I can't go there.
I joined about 11 years ago.
Nat King Cole.
Was a merry old
song. Oh, shut up. You silly goose.
When somebody loves you, it's no good unless she loves you all the way.
You notice how much better he does his own people than our people?
That's the Rat Pack, recorded at the Sands in 1963. My guest, Gerald Early, is the editor of the new book, The Sammy Davis Jr. Reader. He wrote the opening essay. Gerald Early, how does that sound to you now?
I think it's uncomfortable to listen to it. I would think, actually, at the time when Davis was even going through it, it was rather uncomfortable for him.
In reading all that you read to put together the Sammy Davis Reader, do you feel like you understand any more now what motivations Frank Sinatra and Dean Martin had when they were ridiculing Sammy Davis Jr. during performances? Was it just like good-natured stuff, or do you think that there were more hostile things going on beneath the surface?
I think they both liked Sammy Davis, and they probably both thought they were being funny, and, you know, they were all kind of high when they were up there anyway. And so, you know, when you're high, you're apt to say things that are kind of silly. You have an integrated act at a time when things are kind of racially charged. They're thinking that maybe if we tell jokes like this, it kind of makes the audience more willing to accept the fact that we're an integrated act. And, you know, it kind of relaxes whatever tensions there might be in the audience, because, you know, the audience is probably mostly white. And so, you know, and Sinatra was a liberal guy. He was a guy who, you know, Davis got him to do some civil rights benefits and so forth. And so, you know, I don't think, you know, he's probably trying to be in any way intentionally racist. On the other hand, I think there are other things that are probably going on in their minds at this particular time, and what's going on racially in the United States at this particular time. And in some ways, for them to be doing the kind of jokes that they're doing, and having Davis as a butt of certain kind of jokes, is perhaps releasing certain tensions for them, as well as it's releasing certain tensions for the audience.
Well, Gerald Early, I'd like to end by asking you to choose one of your favorite Sammy Davis Jr. recordings, a recording that you think shows him at his best. What would you like to play?
Well, I think the best album he made was the record he made with Count Basie that was arranged by Quincy Jones, and just about any track on that record would be fine, because I think he was at the top of his game when he made that record.
Gerald Early, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Did you say I've got a lot to learn? Well, don't think I'm trying not to learn, since this is the perfect spot to learn. Teach me tonight, starting with the ABC of it, right down to the XYZ of it. Help me solve the mystery of it. Come on and teach me tonight. The sky's a blackboard.
Gerald Early is the editor of the new anthology, The Sammy Davis Jr. Reader. Early is a professor of modern letters at Washington University in St. Louis. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Therapy is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Clear, my love. Should the teacher stand so near, my love? Graduation's almost here, my love. Teach me tonight.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, former President Jimmy Carter. He has a new memoir about Christmas in Plains, Georgia. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.